From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noah.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccans. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know a bit of an expanded version. Why am I hearing a new Stuff They Don't Want You to Know episode on Monday, you may be asking yourself? That is because, Paul, maybe if we could get a sound cue here, something dramatic, building anticipation. Perfect. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is officially going to be coming to you every single day of the week until we go crazy, until we get disappeared, black bagged, etc. Don't worry, we'll still have the same deep dive episodes you know and love on Wednesdays and Fridays. However, we're going to add some things to the week. This is our first iteration of what we're calling Strange News. So now, with the help of my collaborators, co-conspirators, the esteemed Noel Brown and Matt Frederick, we are resurrecting, revising, grittily rebooting Strange News Daily into Strange News. We sure hope you like it. We've worked pretty hard on it, and we hope that you enjoy it coming out every Monday. That's our plan right now, right?
Totally. Yeah, no, I'm certainly excited about it, and I really appreciate everybody tuning in for the first installment.
And just to give a little bit of context, what's going to happen here in these episodes, each of us is coming to the table with a news story that we found to be intriguing or weird or strange in some way, and we're going to essentially bring it up, and then we'll all discuss it. And all three of us are going to get that chance, and at the end, you have to vote for whose is the weirdest. No, I'm just joking. That's not a part of it. But we'd totally accept any messages saying, hey, yours was the weirdest, or yours was the whatever. We're interested in what you think about all these stories.
Okay. So without further ado, I think I have the honor of being the first to the table today with an article from the National Review by Karine Hajjar, and the headline is U.S. considers TikTok ban as Chinese threat to global internet freedom grows. There's a lot to unpack here. I only just recently found out about this and had to hear more. TikTok, as many folks know, I know because my kid was on it when it was called music.ly or Musical.ly. It's sort of like an app that is, I guess, the new answer to Vine in the vacuum where Vine was, where people were making short little videos, whether, you know, showcasing kind of dance routines or little comedy sketches or what have you. The thing about TikTok is a lot of it is meant to be lip synced to, and people copy each other's dances or bits or, you know, lip syncs or whatever. And it's really gone absolutely bonkers since quarantine. People that would have been, you know, totally ragging on a service like this or an app like this or would never in a million years think they'd be on it are all over it. And it has really taken the internet by storm. I think I read it's been downloaded like more than a billion times or something insane like that. But as it turns out, it is owned and operated by a Chinese company by the name of ByteDance that has, as many corporations in China do, very close ties to the Chinese Communist Party. And in a recent interview on Fox News, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo indicated that the United States is certainly looking at banning outright TikTok. State Department already forbids it to be downloaded on any, you know, government-issued phones. And it's really causing quite a stir. And the reason for this is that the Chinese government is very well known for their kind of iron grip on the internet of China and the way users perceive it. So for a company like that to be so massive here in the United States, there are potential, you know, conflicts of interest there, I suppose is the term you would use. I'm really interested to hear what you guys think about this. The idea that they could use this social media platform to stockpile data about users, or even go a step further as far as spying on American citizens.
Well, I'll jump in quickly here. ByteDance, by the way, ByteDance, if you want to look it up for your own research. It feels a lot like conversations that maybe I haven't looked at or heard news about in other countries when they're talking about, let's say, a service like Twitter or Facebook or some other social media that's a US-based company, where you're imagining that this perhaps foreign government-linked entity may be gathering all the information of all the users in your country that are downloading it. It's interesting. It definitely feels like something that would be happening, because we know a lot of these companies, especially social media companies that have apps attached to them where it's physically in a phone of an end user, that user is being tracked in some way, shape, or form. You know, on the surface, it's for advertising purposes, right? And it's for making money for that app to be able to sell that data to somebody else or to use it internally. When thinking about it, of the United States having, or thinking at least about attempting to put a stop to an app and its use within the United States because it is based in a foreign country, that to me is something brand new, of at least something to think about.
Yeah, I had some deep dives in this earlier on the original version of Strange News Daily. There's a lot to it, and I think in the West we are maybe missing some stuff here. First, shout out to everybody who was listening to this this very important news, and then said, why are we worried about TikTok? Facebook, the Alphabet boys, and Google are already doing the same thing. And they're doing it all the time. That's true. But to your point, Noel, the difference here is that, legally speaking, the government of China has much wider powers when it comes to retrieving information from a quote-unquote private venture. TikTok is definitely a potential security risk. I mean, imagine you're a diplomat, your two kids love TikTok because they do dance challenges. It's not hard to pull information and then sort of Kevin Bacon degrees of separation your way into what, like diplomatic conversations. You just start pulling the spider webs and pulling the yarn. Here's one thing that's interesting, because, you know, in the U.S., a lot of observers are saying that the White House or the current administration is behind banning TikTok, partially because of a security concern, but partially because the current president is angry about the effectiveness of TikTok activism. When hundreds of thousands of K-pop fans started trolling speaking events, right? Reserving totally. Seats. Yeah. So that definitely plays a part. But we have to remember, India banned TikTok. There's a hilarious story. This is in step, by the way, with the border clashes between India and China, which very well may spark a regional war. Millions of people tuned in on TikTok to just watch this guy eat chicken wings. That's like all he did until the lights went out on TikTok. And now, if you're keeping track of the closures or the bans of TikTok, the U.S. military, or the U.S. Army, excuse me, and the Navy have already banned service members from using TikTok, at least on their government phones. I think Wells Fargo banned it too. There's more to come. Coast Guard,
Air Force.
And so now the question is the U.S. going to ban it entirely? And if so, if they do, what happens? Because India, pretty much soon after they banned TikTok, essentially a TikTok clone that was native to India rose in its place. I mean, wouldn't that happen?
Did not know about that. Ben, do you see this as being in any way retaliatory by the Trump administration, pointing fingers for, say, in their eyes, causing the current pandemic that we are involved in. And also, you know, the way China often kind of holds our feet to the fire economically. Is this kind of our way of kind of clapping back a little bit?
I mean, I could only speculate that that's a reasonable assumption. Like the main issue or the main question is there seriously a security risk? And the answer is, of course, yes. Because not just because it's TikTok or it's in China, it's a security risk because it's a social media app. That's kind of why they exist. Each and every one, the majority of popular social media apps are Trojan horses or have the potential to be such. But to your point about whether this is retaliatory, we have to remember that there is there's very much a cold war going on right now between China and the U.S., and it's taking place across the internet, across the South China Sea, in trade room talks, everywhere. It's escalating.
Absolutely. And also to your point, Ben, these bans, you know, within the military, branches of the military have been in place since last year, since December or January even. So any retaliatory, you know, implication would just be in making it larger scale, banning it among, you know, my kid, for example, who would be crushed. That is her social media platform of choice. I'm not kidding. Like that is where she has the most followers and interacts with, you know, her cosplay friends. And it's a thing. And it really is. Is largely, I think, maybe some of the concern is coming from just the ballooning popularity of the app. And something I didn't realize is using something called shadow bans, which is something that's employed in general by social media companies, for example, against sex workers. Oftentimes, sex workers are shadow banned because of their content. And rather than just being, you know, canceled or having their credentials revoked, their content just isn't reaching their followers. So it's a way to limit who actually sees content that's being put out. And for example, there was some evidence that a user in 2019, Feroza Aziz, had her account suspended after putting up a makeup tutorial that had some kind of almost subconscious or sort of like secretly kind of veiled criticisms of Chinese mass detention of the Uyghur Muslim population in Xinjiang province, and also references to things like Tiananmen Square or the protests that are going on in Hong Kong. Also, they have a way of kind of making sure that stuff doesn't filter through even to U.S. users.
One interesting thing to point out here with regards to TikTok's data is that the company says, at least, that the user data that it stores is not physically located in China, and it is backed up elsewhere in Singapore, at least according to Wired. And here's a quote here. Our data centers are located entirely outside of China, and none of our data is subject to Chinese law. That's a company statement from TikTok. So, I mean, that's interesting alone there when you're thinking that the Chinese government, the Communist Party, would have to go, to some lengths to get that information if they were attempting to use it for some nefarious purpose. You know, who's to say TikTok wouldn't have some kind of backroom deal with a government or a company? But ByteDance actually in the past has had some issues with the Chinese government and the Communist Party in some other social media news apps that it's created in the past. And the CEO actually at one point had to make a public apology about the use of those apps, which is interesting to me. I don't know, but the quote is really telling, and you know, it speaks to a lot of other things we've discussed on this show. I'm just going to say it right here. He says, the product has gone astray, posting content that goes against socialist core values. It's all on me. I accept all the punishment since it failed to direct public opinion in the right way.
Whoa. Yeah, that's a question I had for you, Ben. I mean, if we take a real like sci-fi kind of dystopian approach to this, is this kind of infiltration with an app that catches on with the youth a way to spread communism abroad, a way to, you know, make a new generation of American, you know, kids okay with that? Is there the potential for indoctrination, subtle ways? You know what I mean? I just wonder.
I mean, and that's an interesting question, Noel, because it would be, it would technically, I think, fall under the category of what's called soft diplomacy. That's a more physical example of that would be the Confucius Institutes that opened up around the world to familiarize people with what the Communist Party considers official Chinese culture. And we have to admit, Chinese culture is super cool. Just the history is amazing. But right now, the PRC globally is a little more concerned with domestic information control than they are with expansion of information globally or expansion of narrative globally. You'll see narrative expansion in terms of directed, focused efforts to certain regions of the world or countries. But right now, the U.S., maybe we're being U.S.-centric here. Right now, the U.S. is not especially receptive, the common person in the U.S., to that kind of propaganda if they were doing it. It feels like it definitely has the ability to be or the capacity to become an intelligence gathering tool. And Uncle Sam is super, super worried about it. But right now, we don't. I don't know. It seems more likely that if there were a nefarious end or an ulterior motive for propagating TikTok, it would be to gather intelligence more so than to win hearts and minds. But, I mean, you could do it. Just get people to copy the right dance, you know?
Right, right. And just to point out, the National Review is a right-wing publication, but this is a national story, and we have multiple other sources for this. But from that perspective, this is a quote from the article. And I think this is interesting because it's sort of what we were just talking about. In the face of China's threats to the freedom of the world's internet, the Trump administration should be applauded for considering a ban on TikTok. As Chinese censorship, surveillance, and propaganda spread worldwide, the U.S. has a chance to fight back and change the trajectory of the information age for the better.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's sort of, if you wanted to be absolutely brutal about it and a little bit cold, you could say maybe the U.S. or maybe the West in general is not so much upset that social media is used for intelligence gathering as they are that someone else is getting the benefits. You know what I mean? Because U.S. hasn't raised a big stink about Facebook.
It is a really interesting time we're living in where a big move, a big political or almost long game move is to ban a competitive country's tech companies. Isn't that
weird? Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's so strange to me that that's a chess move at this point. Ban it and then, like, kind of as we alluded to earlier, introduce your own version of whatever that thing was that was extremely popular. Huh. Because it really could be, or at least has the potential, no matter how minute, to be a way of spying on some other country's citizens.
Yeah. What I really appreciate about that point, Matt, is that you're putting into context a larger pattern. We can't forget that there are multiple countries that have said, forget the worldwide internet. We're going to make our own internet. Insert Bender from Futurama joke here. But the idea is that we want to, the people in power, the people responsible for making decisions, we want to have vertical control. We want stem to stern, soup to nuts control of all the capabilities of something. And we definitely don't want back doors in any technology from a foreign source, which is, you know, by the way, the reason that the U.S. wants to be careful about that is because we know people do it because we do it all the time.
We're all the protagonists and antagonists at all times, guys.
No, 100%. It's interesting to even think about it from that perspective, but you got it. You nailed it, Matt. I think this is a story that we're going to continue looking into and seeing as it develops and maybe even do more on it down the road. But in the meantime, we've got some more strange news coming your way after a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey And we've returned. Let's stay on the Asian continent for our second story today. As longtime listeners know, several of us, I guess I should just out myself here, I have a weird fascination longstanding with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK, better known as North Korea here in the West. North Korea is also called the Hermit Kingdom. It has been in a state of unending war officially since the 50s. It is distinct. It's dangerous. It's a scary place. And it's also an opaque place. A lot of people have no idea what's really happening on the ground there. Before the proliferation of very affordable communications technology, it was almost a black box. And we only knew, we being everyone who lives outside of North Korea, we only knew what was going on in there based on reports of defectors that sometimes couldn't be proven or corroborated, or based on very limited human intelligence, relatively limited satellite imaging technology. That's changed now in a globally connected world, but we still don't really know what's going on. And that is why many, many people across the globe now are very concerned about the succession of power in North Korea. North Korea is currently ruled by a guy named Kim Jong-un. We've discussed him in several previous episodes. He is the grandson of Kim Il-sung, who is considered the eternal president of the country and was the founder of what we call DPRK today. However, if you'll recall, relatively recently, Kim Jong-un disappeared for some amount of time. And this led to pretty alarmist, kind of breathless, pearl-clutching reports in the U.S. and in South Korea that he had died, possibly due to COVID-19, possibly due to any number of his health issues, including he's got a bum ticker, apparently. And then, surprise, surprise, he did like a dictator power move. He came back out. At first, we thought maybe it was just a video that had been archived and they were just trying to maintain stability. But there's something else interesting happening that I thought would bear discussion here. His sister is quickly becoming the favorite to be the next leader of North Korea. Her name is Kim Yo-jong. And this story I would categorize as a weird flex, guys. One of the biggest news stories in domestic North Korean media is that Kim Yo-jong officially got permission from the government to watch the U.S. celebrations of July 4th, not just for this year, but every year going forward. And this sounds like a small deal to us, but it's a big, big deal there because it's a very propaganda-sensitive country, and July 4th is one of the most propagandistic things that America does.
Just like watch? Like on like a feed? Like watch news coverage? Or what are we talking here?
DVDs.
Wow. That is wild.
But I guess I don't understand because it's on the face, as you said, fully propaganda being exported by the U.S., by any country that's celebrating a day like that of their independence or their founding or something like that. I mean, it's almost like on the face of it, hey, guess what, guys? Everybody, even in the country where we're celebrating, this is kind of propaganda for how great we are. I mean, it's interesting that she would need permission to watch that. Huh.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that is confirmed by North Korean state media, which is a real eye-opener to read that stuff. Just the way that it's written, it's kind of like they're the official messages. It sounds like the person writing them is paid per amount of times they pick up the thesaurus by their keyboard. But it's really fun read. However, we can't dismiss this just as propaganda because, you know, you have to study the enemy to know the enemy, right? This also was not a move occurring in a vacuum. It was Kim Yo-jong, not Kim Jong-un, who just kiboshed the idea of another summit with the United States.
and said, no, we don't need it. Mainly, you know, in geopolitical circles, it's pretty clear that the current U.S. administration sees those summits as tremendous PR opportunities and, you know, kind of like a win when it comes to the votes and the elections coming up in November. But the weird thing is, it seems that Kim Yo-jong is very into the internet because cyber warfare campaigns are picking up at an unprecedented rate. You're not going to see this entire story laid out in a single news article. We had to pull a couple things to get here. But cyber warfare, asymmetrical warfare online, is like the best move if you are outnumbered in a conventional military. And we don't know yet. It's still such a secretive regime or a secretive government. We don't know yet what's going to happen. We don't know how long Kim Jong-un is going to last. We don't know if his sister will become the first female leader of the country. We don't know if the country is going to collapse, honestly. The signals that we're getting from this are distressing. They haven't really, they're being mentioned in one-offs in Western news, but without making a prediction, I would say keep your eye on this country because it's not equipped to handle COVID-19. The populace is aware that there is a world where you're less likely to starve just over the border. People are risking life and limb to get out of there. And we may see the collapse of North Korea within our lifetime.
Question, and forgive me if you mentioned this and I missed it. Why does she want to? Is she just a younger generation that's fascinated by American culture? Is that what it, or is there something else to it that I'm missing?
I think it's studying the enemy, but you raise a good point about fascination with Western culture. It's weird because Kim Jong-un was educated at a very posh school in Europe, and he loves U.S. basketball. He loves American films. Culture, I guess you could say culture and war are two of the primary exports of the United States. And he definitely loves the culture part. So his sister may like that as well. It may just be a I like to watch the show kind of thing, but I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to see some modeling of U.S. propaganda techniques used in North Korea to great effect. The U.S. is good at propaganda. We do it all the time. Nobody talks about it, but we do it to ourselves. And that's what really hurts, to quote Radiohead.
Excellent. I would point out, just I'm fascinated by the language Kim Yo-jong uses, and tell me what you guys think about this. I'll read a quick quote from this Politico article that we found here. They're talking about reigniting these talks and how the United States, or at least the Trump administration, has been saying that, hey, there's a possibility we're going to get back into these nuclear discussions with the DPRK. And this is what Kim Yo-jong had to say. Quote, assuming that we hold the summit talks now, it is too obvious that it will only be used as boring boasting coming from someone's pride. Which is really interesting, like you said, that I think both sides, if you want to call them that, in this kind of exchange are very good at what they do when they signal publicly about one or the other. And then she continued down the line there within wherever they're quoting from in this Politico article to reference the Christmas gift that was referenced prior to this time by Kim Jong-un about essentially a nuclear weapon that could be sent somewhere fairly close to them. On the eve of the elections is what she's referring to here. So like as the Trump administration is going into an election, they are saying, yeah, just remember we could give you a little nuclear gift on that day if we wanted to. I think it's just fascinating to read the language of this, what do you call it? The back and forth, almost Cold War exchanges that go across the bow here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like a form of one-upsmanship in some weird way.
Mm-hmm. You're very, very close. The phrase is brinksmanship, and it's exactly, it's the same thing. It's basically so much of international affairs is like, we've used this analogy before. We've said international affairs is a house party where everybody thought there would be enough beer and snacks to go around, and now they find out there's much less, and they're fighting for it. But in this situation, when people are in this situation where there's conflict involved, it's like the world stage is a crowded bar, and they're, you know, the nations saying they're going to fight are going like, you know, come at me, bro. Come at me. Why'd you bump me? Why'd you bump me, bro? And then they're getting their friends to like hold them back. And they're like, hold me back. China, hold me back. You got my back, right? Okay. Come at me, bro. Christmas gift. What? And this, it feels silly, but it can be really dangerous. And I know it's the reason I wanted to bring this up on today's show is because we're seeing a lot of reports about horrific things happening in detainment camps in China, in detainment camps here in the U.S. And we have to remember that these kind of camps have existed for decades and decades in North Korea. And the West knows, the West knew, the West has never interfered beyond, you know, sanctions, often related more to nuclear weaponry than human rights. So at this point, given the instability, I mean, North Korea just let out an official statement admitting that COVID-19 is spreading, and they said stopping COVID-19 is more important than the economy, which is a lesson some other countries could learn, I imagine, some people would say. But keep an eye out for it. It is in a more unstable time than it has been since Kim Jong-il originally took power after the death of Kim Il-sung. But assuming we don't fall into the grips of a global nuclear exchange, we're going to pause for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back with more strange news. And we're back. What do you say, Matt? It falls to you. You've been telling us off air that we're going to get weird with it.
Well, you guys, you know, you come in here with your important articles about global news, stuff that actually matters. Well, I got something different for everybody. We're going to read an article here from a place maybe you didn't expect. The Lot. That's what it's called. The Lot Media Center. This is the Lottery of Australia, and they've got a little place where they put out essentially PR. That's really all this is. It's to let you know, hey, here's a feel-good story about somebody who won the lottery, and you can win too, and you should play the old lottery and all that. But this one struck me just a little bit because of the circumstances that led to the winning numbers. So just to quickly go through it, there's a thing called the Gold Lotto Draw in Australia. And, you know, it's a lottery like any other. You pick some numbers, and if those numbers come up, you're going to win some money. Well, there's one woman in Queensland who, you know, did the whole thing. She put some numbers in. She bought a ticket. Or rather, she bought a ticket and put some numbers in. Then she won $1 million. And she went through and she confirmed it with, you know, the whole lottery company and everything. And this is what she had to say. The numbers came to me in a dream about 15 years ago. That's 15 years. I literally saw them appear one by one, and I've been playing them in that exact order ever since. The numbers have always been good to me. I've always won little amounts over the years, but now this, it's amazing. So my question to you guys, that's really all I've got for a new story.
Dude, no, this is amazing. What an optimistic and lovely way to wrap the episode.
I know.
But magic does happen. This is incredible.
My question to you guys is, do you think there is any realm of possibility, you know, as skeptical as we may be, that she in some way was given those numbers either by herself or by some other outside force that predicted that this would happen in some way. Do you guys think there's any realm of possibility that that could have happened?
Sure.
Yeah?
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, anything is possible. Not to be relativistic about it and not to sound dismissive, but I mean, yeah, sure. We have no idea how the human mind works. We kind of get the neurochemical stuff. We get that part, right? We've solved the idea of how the gas moves through the engine, but we don't know why there's a car, and we don't really know where it came from and where it's going in a cognitive sense. We also have some tricky statistics here, I would say, not to be too much of a Donnie Downer about it, but how many millions of other people have been doing the same thing for decades, and maybe they did it their entire life, and they got two or three numbers once, and they got four even, and then they passed away. We're hearing about this story because this is the time that it worked. You know what I mean?
That's a really great point. It just happened to work this time, maybe.
Yeah. And so the number, it's a pretty complex series of numbers, right? It's 15, 1, 41, 42, 8, and 45, with supplementary numbers being 20 and 30, which I think you need to get all of those to hit the big one, right? Isn't that right?
I honestly don't know exactly how
the gold lottery works. I'm not a lottery guy myself. Point is, these combinations of numbers are difficult to hit. You know what I mean? It's like you can't just, you know, the likelihood of playing the same numbers over and over again and having it randomly hit, very slim. This is fascinating. Let's see. How many times did she play it?
Well, she played a lot.
Yeah.
At least according to her. And, you know, you're talking about roughly 15 years. There are around 15 years of play. You're looking at a lot of money that's been spent on that lottery over the years. And the big question for me, though, is when we're thinking about dreams, and I think we might be due for another episode on dreams. I know we've talked about it several times in the past on this show, about seeing shadow people and sleep paralysis and lucid dreaming, a couple of things like that. But it's still, as you mentioned earlier, Ben, an area of our brains and our lives that we still don't have concrete answers on. And, you know, we've had psychologists and psychoanalysts over the years give us like their takes essentially on what they think dreaming is and that act and where we go and what happens. Everyone from Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, to those guys in the 1970s that we've mentioned before, Alan Hobson and Robert McCarley, who talked about dreams being more of a random firing that's occurring rather than, you know, some of the older concepts of it being, you know, us psychologically getting through our sexual desires or our more base needs or whatever. To me, I just wonder if there is more to the consciousness, the altered consciousness that we go into when we're dreaming. I don't know. It makes me want to talk about it more.
I agree.
It's interesting, too, that this happened in Australia, which has, you know, the Aboriginal tribes and the concept of the dreaming or the dream time, which is, I don't know, I mean, not that they're directly related, but it is certainly a kind of mystical set of beliefs that are wrapped up in this notion of the dream time, which we actually had Annie Rees on the show to talk about her experiences in Australia with some of these tribes.
That's correct. There's a point you make, Matt, that I want to explore a little bit further, at least in today's episode, and we can return to it in a deep dive in the future. It's the definition of consciousness. We don't really have one. We know that we feel like we think, and we know that based on the behavior of others, it seems that they are undergoing the same dubious condition known as sentience. But there was a great sci-fi story I read recently called The Life Cycle of Software Objects. Without spoiling it, it introduces what I thought was a very good definition of consciousness, which is that we are maybe the we that we think of when we think, what are we? What am I? Maybe that is not necessarily a single point in the body. Maybe it's not even a single point metaphysically in some dimension or vibration that we cannot understand. Perhaps we are just the thing that we think of as ourselves. It's simply a pattern, right? And it molds itself over time. It's a complex sort of think like something like a series of opening and closing tubes, but also a mobile, like you would hang over maybe a child's crib. And that pattern, that movement, the space between those things, that is as much of a part of us as the neurons that we can see. It's kind of like the difference between just speed and velocity. I don't know. I'll just send you this story. Ted Chiang, he does a better job explaining it here. But the reason I'm bringing that up is that the brain, as I think we said in previous episodes, the brain is at best hardware. The closest analogy we have to a consciousness is software. And since we know that software, through hardware, can interact with other things, then there's, you know, it's not conclusively proven, but it is therefore somewhat naive to assume that the pattern that we think of as consciousness exists in some sort of firewalled location. Our brains are inundated, just like every other part of our bodies, with so many types of energy, radiation, vibration, I don't know, microwaves. How many times do you use a cell phone? I mean, even bananas have a little bit of radiation to them. Our brains are awash in things. They do not exist in a vacuum. So therefore, I do not think it is out of the question. I do not think it is unreasonable that our minds could be interacting somehow with something else. Or, you know, maybe her subconscious is just really smart and is telling her this.
But in this case, we're really talking about precognition, right? Somehow, if there was any sand to this, it would be something interacting, or herself even interacting, to give her information that she'll need 15 years in the future, in the hopes that she would record that information and remember it, and then use it in the time when it was needed. Because those numbers aren't going to hit again, at least for a long time, right? So it's you know, if there were something to it, you'd have to drill down so deeply.
That's the thing for me. Like, you know, the fact that it even hit in her lifetime is fascinating, with just like how many possibilities and permutations when you're dealing with two-digit numbers. You know, I'm no mathematician, but any listeners out there, let us know what the odds are for getting a perfect match on that many in a sequence of two-digit numbers. Very, 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 very difficult. Probably impossible, or very difficult for like an algorithm to crack. If, let's say, you're trying to force your way into someone's computer, you know, login, or, you know, there are things that can do forced, you know, they'll just try all these different combinations of numbers in the hopes that they'll eventually get to it. When you deal with, that's if you're dealing with like single digit numbers in a sequence of maybe six or something. These are double digit numbers in a sequence of, I think, five or six. So incredibly difficult to hit that just randomly. I don't know, man, I'm with you. I think, Ben, you did a really good job of sort of bridging the gap between the mystic side of it and the sort of like, you know, just the brain chemical side of it. I love this, and I think it's a wonderful way to end our first episode of Strange News.
Quantum entanglement exists. The existence of precognition necessitates assuming the existence of linear time. And all that we know about time is that so far it seems to move in one direction. But recent science has discovered the rules of the road aren't always the same, especially when we get down to very, very small things. So I ask you then, what is the size of a thought? All right, sorry. That was it.
No, that's great. I was just going to point out that you can find The Life Cycle of Software Objects on Amazon right now. And the hardcover version of it is $206. Woo!
No, buy the short story collection Exhalations. It should be in there.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah. And I think you can get like the full compendium of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman, which also uses the idea of the dreaming and dream time and takes a lot of cues from those Aborigine myths that we're talking about. So really, really cool stuff here and really great fodder for pop culture. It's been used in science fiction, you know, a lot since like the 80s and continues to be. So really, God, Matt, what a good find.
Well, all I'll say is, I've been having a lot of really messed up nightmares lately, and I certainly hope that I don't have any kind of precognitive abilities because I don't want any of those things to come true. All right. Well, hey, hope you're having better dreams than me. Write to us. Let us know what you think about all this stuff. Let us know what you've been dreaming about, if you're down with that. We'd certainly be interested to hear it, especially if you've been predicting something or if something has been resonating deeply within you, because this whole quarantine situation and all the other things, a lot of other things that are going on in the world right now have been leading to some weird disruptions in sleep patterns and stuff. So tell us about what you've been experiencing, what you think about everything we've talked about on this episode. You can find us on social media. We are all over the place.
Right. Facebook, you can find our Facebook group. Here's Where It Gets Crazy. That's a really nice kind of real-time way to keep up with your fellow conspiracy realists. And we pop in there as well. And couldn't have a better group of folks. Lots of cool conversations and memes. And usually when a new episode drops, the conversation kicks into high gear. Really interested to see what you guys think of this new schedule. I had a great time today, and I hope you all listening did too. You can also find us on the usual places and social media as Conspiracy Stuff or Conspiracy Stuff Show. If you wish, you can find us as individual people. I am on Instagram at How Now Noel Brown.
I'm on Instagram @Frederick_iHeart, I think.
You can find me on Twitter where I am at Ben Bolin HSW or on Instagram where I am at Ben Bolin. If you are a person who does not care for social media, totally get it. There is pretty solid evidence that social media can have deleterious effects on the mind. So why not kick it old school? You can give us a call directly where we are 1-833-STDWYTK.
Yeah.
I don't think it's happening, guys. It was a good effort, though. It was a good hustle.
Well, the people, you know, our fellow listeners at home are hopefully chanting along or at the very least finding our attempt to chant together endearing, if nothing else.
If you don't want to do any of that stuff and you want to just write to us, you know, like we used to in days of yore, you can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.